Well, good morning and welcome everyone to Live Dharma Sunday. This is Reverend Koyo Kubose here. Okay, well, it's April 17th. Last week, recently I was, it's around springtime. It's kind of nice. It's Hanamatsuri or Flower Festival in Japanese, which is Buddha's birthday. Or technically, Siddhartha Gautama's birthday. You could say that the Buddha's birthday was when he became enlightened, which in the Mahayana tradition is in December, observed in December, December 8th, Bodhi Day, or Wisdom Day. But as a prince of King Suddhodana, Queen Maya, in Northeast India, current day Nepal, Siddhartha Gautama was born in Lumbini Garden on April 8th, about 2,500 years ago. So in the Mahayana tradition, many temples observe this as one of the major religious holidays. So I spoke at, I was invited to speak at the San Francisco Buddhist Church and drove up there, and it's always nice to see colleagues, Reverend Ron Kobata, who I knew in Japan in the 70s when we both overlapped in our times there. He grew up in San Francisco, and I have a lot of ties to the Bay Area. Went to college there, graduated from Berkeley, lived 2 years in San Francisco, attending San Francisco State University, married a Berkeley girl there and all this. And I think it, once in a while it's good to review one's own past, where one came from. It helps to clarify where one's going or wants to go, you know, to see how one's life journey is unfolding. And it gives a nice awareness of the karmic interconnections that we have, you know. Well, today we're going to have as our guest to give a Dharma glimpse, Michael Shinyo Lawrence, who was part of the graduating class of Lay Minister LM3, or the third group to go through. Graduated last May, and he lives in Texas, and he works as a counselor in a maximum security prison. So, for our today's Dharma Glimpse, Michael Shinyo Lawrence.
As some of you know, I work in a maximum security prison in Texas. This facility houses some of the most dangerous convicts in the state. There are frequent assaults against staff and other inmates. Weapons are made and hidden, and officers and volunteers are manipulated into bringing in dangerous contraband such as cell phones and drugs. Because of this, there are limited movements throughout the unit, and we must count inmates several times day and night. Some of the inmates at this facility only leave their cell for an hour a day. With all these restrictions, it would seem that there is no such thing as freedom here. One evening, I came to work and was assigned to run some outside gates. At certain times of the shift, there's very little or no movement through those gates. I sat outside enjoying what was left of the daylight. Several sparrows were flying in and out of the fences without any restrictions. These sparrows were completely free, flying around in the maximum security prison. A sparrow is free because it lives in the here and now. It is free where it is. What are they singing? Benimbutsu, perhaps? There are also stray cats that live inside these fences. They're there because inmates feed them. It's against rules for them to take any food from the chow hall, but many of them will put extra bread in their pockets and toss it out for the birds and stray cats. Where I was posted that night was between all four chow halls. I watched as a cat approached the area in search of some food. soon one of the windows in the chow hall cracked open, and I saw an inmate who was working in that chow hall drop a piece of hot dog from the last meal out of the window for it. It may seem unlikely to find compassion in a place like this, but compassion is also free. While sitting outside watching the sun go down, I noticed some sort of seed floating by. I tried to catch it to see what it was, but I was unable to. Enlightenment is like that floating seed one is unable to catch. The seed is free. It did not need to be caught. To chase enlightenment is to live in samsara. To see the extraordinary in the ordinary is to catch a glimpse of the pure land. I realized that all these things were ordinary, everyday things. A sparrow is not the most beautiful bird. It's not colorful. It doesn't have the prettiest song. A floating seed is nothing special and can go unnoticed unless it causes you to sneeze. Stray cats can even be a nuisance. For many, a dandelion is only a weed. But all these ordinary things have much to teach us about freedom. When we're able to be free from ourselves, we can see our interconnectedness with the rest of the world, and we can learn from ordinary, everyday things. The Dharma is free, and it's all around us, right where we are. Thank you.
Thank you. On this topic of freedom, you know, when you hear a Dharma talk, you might process it in terms of a teaching. Oh, this is an interesting teaching. As sort of like, you know, in a filing cabinet type of a thing. Oh, it goes in this folder or oh, on that topic. And of course, we're interested in the teaching for ourselves, but everything's always to what degree, to what depth. When you hear a Dharma talk, it's as though it's only for you, about your life. There must be an urgency, sort of, about it. It must be sort of like you traveled and climbed the Himalayas and made a big trek, you know, to that stereotypical wise man on the top, hermit, and got to ask him your one question. Then you really listen carefully. But when things are freely given, we don't pay much attention. That's why in that commercial, when someone's whispering, hey, you know, then our ears perk up. Even if we're in a crowded subway and we hear two friends whispering together, hey, I found out something important. Well, we pay special attention to that whisper. We think it's something hidden, special. Whereas things that are freely given, we take them for granted. So when we hear, great teaching requires great listening. It's not so much, ooh, that was a great teaching. What kind of a listener? We hear a lot, but we don't really deep listen. Well, I want to talk about this topic of freedom then. Are you free? Do you have, you know, what kind of context are we talking about when we talk about personal freedom? When we run into a problem, and that's sort of the definition of life. Things don't go as we want, as easily as we want, when we want. And a good thing, too. Our life would be really terrible if all of our wishes came true so easily. But we don't really have to think about that because that's not human life. But again, we're talking about degrees. To what extent does life's obstacles and difficulties hit us? And how do we respond? Can we deal with them? Or do we suffer unnecessarily? Do we feel hemmed in and say, hey, I'm in this kind of bad situation. How come? What? This is not fair. This is not right. We don't feel liberated and have that free feeling of moving with the lightness of being. Well, I remember a story. I think it's a must be a true story. And some follow-up experiences I had about this story, because this story, I consider it a major teaching, a major illustration, a life-changing teaching. I'm whispering. It's about a horsefly Buddha. Maybe you know this story. A man came to visit a teacher and was telling the teacher all his problems. The teacher seemed distracted, and the man said, "Say, I'm telling you, pouring out all my problems, but you don't seem to be paying, you know, close attention to me." And the teacher said, "Oh, sorry, I was noticing this horsefly trying to get out of the room, but he keeps hitting his head against the window screen." Now, this is a story that takes place in Japan. Japanese houses, the rooms have sliding window screens, and there's usually a atrium or a garden, and the sliding the soji screen doors are always open. The rooms are quite open to the gardens and outside. They live closer to nature. And the teacher commented, "Even with all this open space to the outside, this horsefly keeps hitting his head against the window screen. Bang, bang, bang. There's nothing to prevent him from easily flying to freedom. The only thing that's, it's his own stubbornness." And it occurred to me that human beings are the same way. With sudden insight, the man realized he had received the great teaching. So you see, it's our stubbornness. When we run up against a difficulty or obstacle in life, we say, "Hi, how come this is like this? This is," and we complain and criticize. Well, we have all the freedom and potential flexibility there is. We could, if we have mental flexibility, if we don't get rigidly attached, but our stubbornness, we want it our way, and we don't know how to make it anew our way. How do you accept it and not be defeated, but open up to creative new ways that might be even better than the original desire that we had? What is this? Well, I'll tell you, there's a part two to this story, that this man who received this great teaching, his life was changed, and he was so taken by this message of this, you know, horsefly story that he started to give a talk about it. And he sort of devoted his life to spreading this teaching that changed his life. He began to travel all around to different cities, giving lectures and sharing his experience. Now, while visiting a particular city, a friend had hoped to meet him after the talk. But this friend was a busy businessman and could not meet the man after all. So he told his secretary to go to where the man was speaking and after the talk, give him, you know, a gift. Now, it turns out that this busy businessman secretary was having severe personal problems, and in fact, she had decided to commit suicide. She thought she was going to, said, "Well, I'm going to do this today after work." So, but my boss said to go give this gift to his friend, so I'm going to take care of that errand, and then afterwards I'm going home and I'm going to kill myself. To put it, to put it bluntly. She arrived in time to hear the man give his talk about the stubborn horsefly story. Now she was so moved by this story. Because, you know, you have to realize this. She was motivated. She was in such a motivational state of despair that story hit home. Huh? The right words at the right time. She was so moved that when she went up to the man, she gave him her boss's gift, and she told him about her plans to commit suicide that evening. But because of hearing that story, she had a new lease on life. Now, when I first heard about this story, there was a sort of a follow-up Buddhist sectarian humor thrown in at the end here, which is, you know, kind of interesting. The woman. Now, in Japan, Jodo Shinshu or Shin Buddhism, that central figure of focus there is Amida Buddha. She was a Shin Buddhist. It's one of the largest denominations in Japan, together with Zen, those two of Mahayana Buddhism. And Shin Buddhists, they often do recitation of the Nembutsu, or Namu Amida Butsu. Namu means, oh, I take refuge in, I'm one with, or I thank. Amida Butsu. Butsu is Buddha. Amida Buddha is the Buddha of infinite light and light, infinite wisdom, perfect compassion. So it's saying that I'm one with this idealized cosmic Buddha that represents these spiritual qualities. Okay? I take refuge in. Okay. So they often recite Namu Amida Butsu. So the woman, shedding tears of joy, she says, Namu Amida Butsu. And the man quipped, don't thank Amida Buddha, thank the horsefly Buddha. Now apparently, in Japanese, the word for horsefly is abu. So there's a little play on words in the Japanese language. Instead of saying Namu Amida Butsu, you should say Namu Abuddha Butsu. Thank you to the horsefly Buddha. It's something very ordinary, a horsefly, that we should hold up as a Buddha too, as a source of life-changing Dharma experiences, not just when we're seated in front of the, a statue or in the sanctuary. Huh? You know, once you have a central story like this, many follow-up experiences that I personally had that added even more associations and more depth about this horsefly Buddha story and source of teachings. One time I was in Los Angeles speaking at a temple, and I mentioned this horsefly story. And afterwards, the resident minister said, oh, I like that horsefly story. And we sat down to lunch in the social hall afterwards. On the table, there were several special placemats for guests. And we were sitting at two of them, but there were three empty ones across the table from us. The minister wondered, oh, who are those empty spaces for? I quipped, oh, maybe those are for all the Buddhas of the past, present, and future. They're eating with us. Noticing the flies that were buzzing around, he said, no, no, only flies. We looked at each other and chuckled. There was one last experience that I'd like to share with you. That's even deeper. Some years ago, I was asked to speak at a retreat, a Zen retreat. They were starting a week or 2 week sessions, and I gave a talk at the first session and at the closing session. It was nearby in Evanston, and As a guest teacher in the Zen tradition, Zen Buddhist tradition, they have all kind of different setups, I guess you'd call it. But one thing is they have a sort of a seniority system of senior monks, although this was not a monastery, senior disciple, I guess, students that are have been there longer, more advanced and more trained and so forth. And they have different jobs, you know. And one job is to, if you have a guest teacher coming, to be sort of that teacher's attendant. So I was there, and a young lady, there's a special word for it. I don't remember what the word is in Japanese, but she was my attendant. So if I needed anything, or, you know, she accompanied me while I was there at the center. She was a young black woman, quiet, and it gives you a nice hospitality feeling. If you have any question about anything or practical concerns or whatever, she's right there. Now, as part of the rituals and procedures and so forth, in Zen Buddhism, there's what's called a dokusan, private interview with the teacher during these concentrated retreat sessions. So the resident priest had asked me before, would you like to conduct dokusan? And I said, okay. Now, usually dokusan is with your resident teacher and you, but with a guest teacher, it's a little different because you're not working on certain things and you don't see them, you know, on a consistent basis. But you might get some fresh input, I guess. And I don't know these people. I don't know their background. But I said, okay. So in this center, they had, in addition to the main hall, they had a small guest cottage where overnight a visiting teacher might stay. And it's a small place. This is all Japanese style. And they use that as a dokusan or interview room. And so I'm sitting in there, and whoever's interested in receiving dokusan, they, you know, make their wish known. And my attendant sort of handles the procedure, the order in which they come. She knocks on the door, says the time is up, and then that guy person has to leave, and then the next one goes in. She takes care of this procedure. And people come in and they talk whatever. Now, what you do in a situation like this, or what I do is, you know, they're not coming to see me. They're coming to see a teacher, a Buddha. So I have, when I sit there, prepare myself. In a way, I hate to use the word, but of channeling, because it has certain connotations, but when you sit there, you have a responsibility, you have a role that's beyond my individual personality. I have to become a Buddha. I have to empty myself. I have to let all the Buddhas of the past, present, and future come in. I have to empty myself. You know? And someone comes in. We're sitting on the cushions. I went into deep samadhi. They talk. And we see what comes out of my mouth. Something that they say pulls it out of my mouth, out of me, from dharma, karmic interconnections. Huh? That's, I think, describes the situation. The deeper the question, maybe the deeper response might come out. I don't know. Maybe baloney comes out sometimes. I don't know. Okay? So maybe 5-6 people came in, and it was over, and then the attendant came in, and she wanted to have Dok Sun. She was a pretty serious, intense person. She sat down, and as I said, she was a young black woman. And I mention this because she said, "Sensei, I'm an angry person." And she talked a little bit, and I listened, and I imagine, you know, when you're, I don't know anything about this person, but she obviously had some motivation, she had some talent, she had some character. And when such a person, a woman, a black woman, whatever, if it's in personal life, if it's in business, if it's, there's a lot of obstacles, socially, maybe business-wise, education, you know, given social class, race, and so forth. So-called anger and frustration. Well, what came to my mind was I told her this horsefly story. I said, "Here's this story." And then when the horsefly hits the screen, trying to get to freedom, bang, 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 I put my palm out and the index finger of my other hand, and I hit my finger like the horsefly hitting the screen. Bang, bang, bang. And I said, "This is you. Actually, your problem, you know, it's unsaid, but actually your problem is you ran into this obstacle and you're just hitting yourself. Boom, boom, boom. The whole world is yours. It's free. It's open. You can make your life any way you want. You got all kind of ways to go. You got to accept the reality of who you are, what your circumstances are. Accept it and transcend it and deal with it." Instead of saying, you know, instead of this kind of anger, the uncontrolled, victimized anger. That's all was unsaid when I hit my finger against the palm of my other hand. And she gave out an involuntary sob, and she, tears start coming out. And when someone cries, you start crying too a little bit. But of course, I couldn't show it. Well, I could, but I'm sitting erect. You know, it's a formal situation. This is not a casual social conversation. So I'm sitting there in my pose, but I'm sort of crying. My eyes are welling up, and some nasal discharge coming down. And I suppose depends on your style, one's own style, but I didn't want to break this message in this moment by, I don't have a Kleenex or a handkerchief or anything, and I don't want to wipe it on my robe sleeve or even with my hand. What are you going to do? So you just let it drip down. Hey, gross. Yeah, okay. But she's my attendant, and she noticed. And she got up right away and went into the little bathroom on the side, and she got some Kleenex and brought it to me. And of course, then I could clean myself up. And it was a nice way of that practicalness, her serving me, her compassion, and to end that dramatic, "Hey, this is you," bomb, and her, and this emotional release here. And then go back to your job, your responsibilities, do what the present situation calls for. Get this guy a Kleenex. I don't know. I don't have any follow-up to who this person was and what lasting impact, if any, this kind of experience had. But these kinds of things come out of this horsefly story, and I think we should take it to heart. Huh? Our own stubbornness, but, you know, hitting our head, boom, boom, boom. And I often use this as sort of a mudra, or as a cold gesture, if you will. Okay? And maybe horsefly Buddha is a code word, an abbreviation that starts to carry all these, not only teachings and stories, but these life experiences that I had into something big and solid, you know, as an impactful teaching for me. Because when I see whenever you experience a very impactful thing to others, it impacts you at a deeper level too. You know? So, Horsefly Buddha, in my garden, I see a lot of flies around, and I always think about this story. And that's all for today's broadcast. And my sign-off today is, remember that these horseflies are also Buddha-ful. Thank you.